Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Wednesday, January 7th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And Congress returned to work this week, and immediately they found themselves reacting, not legislating. Lawmakers finally got a briefing today on that surprise operation in Venezuela, and they are demanding answers. And there's also talk now about acquiring Greenland. And all of this comes as midterm politics heat up. Healthcare, affordability, and the ever-present Epstein files all remain top of mind for voters. All of this, of course, has Republicans a little worried because GOP control of the House hangs on by a thread. And Democrats, of course, have messaging issues and identity issues. So today on Studio 2, we're looking forward to the midterms and some of the big battles ahead for both parties. We've got a panel of two reporters who've been covering these issues. And we want to hear from you, our listeners. Our questions of the day are this: what issue do you think should dominate the agenda on Capitol Hill this year? And how do you think the Venezuelan strike will influence the midterms, if at all? You can give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, share the video, but also put your comments in the chat.
Yes, comment away, please, on YouTube and Facebook. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. The email, as always, is studio2@whyy.org. Before we get to all that, a trio of local news stories, and we'll talk a lot today about national politics. But here in PA, we're seeing some movement in the upcoming governor's race.
Oh, yeah.
So probably the biggest lingering question right now in the PA governor's race is whether State Senator Doug Mastriano will jump into the race on the GOP side and challenge party favorite, current state treasurer, Stacey Garrity. Well, we just learned a few hours ago that Mastriano will make his determination public later today after 2 p.m., so we'll keep an eye out for that. If you don't remember, Mastriano won the GOP primary 4 years ago. He's a staunch supporter of President Trump, considered to be on the right flank of the Republican Party. He got to the general and got wiped out by Josh Shapiro 4 years ago. Speaking of Josh Shapiro, he is running for re-election and looks to be in very good shape, at least financially. His campaign announced yesterday they already have $30 million on hand. That's a huge war chest and no need to spend it now because Shapiro doesn't seem to have any major challengers in the Democratic primary.
Yeah, so interesting because Mastriano has been teasing this run for quite some time. Has been pretty confident, at least if you base that, you know, you take a look at his social media. And maybe because polling of Republican primary voters that was released last fall showed that Mastriano would crush Garrity in a primary challenge. I mean, he led her 39% to 20%. Mastriano, of course, is more known to GOP voters. But like you said, Shapiro, you know, whipped him pretty good. And early poll numbers show that Shapiro has a lead over Garrity as well. So regardless of who, I guess, shakes out to be the primary winner on the GOP side, Shapiro has a very strong lead.
Yeah, it's a big mountain to climb, and Shapiro has pretty high favorability ratings right now, according to at least what Quinnipiac released in October. So you have to overcome Shapiro's financial advantage, his seemingly built-in popularity advantage, and what the GOP is trying to avoid here is spending its money on a primary fight.
Yep.
And, you know, for someone like Garrity, assuming she does get through to the general, She'll probably not raise as much money as Shapiro. That would be very, very difficult to do. But what she's trying to do is show early on to national Republican donors and the National
Party. Coalesce around me,
You can coalesce around me. Give me some money. I've got a shot here. And in order to convince them of that, she has to make hay really early, right? You can't imagine it gets closer and closer to November and they suddenly start giving money to Stacey Garrity, right? So like these days matter a lot, I would imagine, for her. Her campaign.
And getting her name out there. Yeah. So folks know who she is.
Story number two, staying in the Commonwealth here, Cherry.
Yeah. Pennsylvania judges have been identifying alleged artificial intelligence hallucinations in briefs filed in court cases in the Commonwealth, including in appeals courts. Some of the high courts are finding this. Very interesting story found on Spotlight PA detailing more than a dozen instances where briefs were filed in cases and they included legal citations or quotes that were totally made up. allegedly by AI. A majority of the error-filled briefs were from non-lawyers who represented themselves, but there were cases, and one fairly embarrassing one in particular, where a veteran law firm was called out by a judge on the record for having clearly made up quotes from case law in their brief. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about AI, using it ethically, and it could help a lot of folks who are pro se litigants, that is, folks who don't have a lawyer, have to write their own briefs. It can be a good thing. And it can also make legal work a lot faster, right? Because lawyers bill by the hour. It makes it a lot cheaper. But, you know, you have to fact check. You have to be thorough in this. And you cannot have wholesale made up case law, made up quotations. And it's scary for judges because that means they got to go back and check everything to make sure. Because if one of those errors get baked into a legal opinion, I mean, goodness gracious, you can only imagine. And so the thing is now you can get fined. The judges are fining litigants who include AI that's made up and not fact checked. Right. And if you're a lawyer, you could get sanctioned by the bar, maybe even lose your license if it's egregious. And so, and it's just embarrassing.
Oh, definitely embarrassing. I assume, though, that like big case, big law firm.
There's a bunch of people
always working, and some lower level people were always doing like the research and the citations, right? So you always had to check the work.
Yeah.
So you still have to check the work. Maybe it's just overconfidence in AI, you know, because it would seem to me that the process shouldn't change all that much. Wouldn't you always have had to check the work of the people doing the citations?
Yes. That's the work. I mean, that was my job as a baby lawyer, that you checked everything but it's sliding through, you know, and the lawyer on the case, very veteran lawyer, I'm not going to put his name out there, you know, because I didn't write this story, but I mean, that's embarrassing for your reputation. This is a well-known law firm, 3 offices in the central of Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
To know that, and you're doing high-profile cases, to know, and then he had no idea. He was very shocked.
But it is a baby bathwater situation. Because like you said, there's the potential here to save people lots of time and lots of money and to expedite work that can be really painstaking.
Yeah.
So, you know, you, on some level, you probably have to figure out how to work with this, because if you don't do it, there is some real downside as well.
Yeah, you got to do that fact check.
Yep. Okay.
This is a transition point.
Thank you, Jerry.
That was bad.
No, thank you for that. I appreciate that.
Lighten it up.
Yep. A famous Camden eatery has been robbed of a very special keepsake. Credit to NJ.com for bringing this story to our attention.
Yeah.
For years, Donkey's Place in Camden has kept a walrus bone behind the bar alongside other animal artifacts. Now, this is the bone that you would find in the walrus's reproductive apparatus.
And it's big.
Yeah, it's Walpole. You know, it's third tusk, you might say.
Yeah.
And anyways, the bone is supposed to be a conversation starter at the bar. And a bartender recently whipped it out and gave it to a customer. And the customer just took it. The dude just stole the walrus bone from Donkey's Place. And now the owners are saying they want the walrus bone back. They don't want to press charges. They just want the dude, who they've caught on camera, by the way, to bring the beloved bone back to the beloved eatery. So whoever you are, if you have the walrus bone, please bring it back to Donkey's Place in Camden. We implore you.
Yeah, bring the bone back. And, you know, my first question was, like, how did he just get out of the establishment with that thing? Because I looked up, and these walrus bones, they're the largest among mammals, you know.
The largest?
And, yeah, they really are. And on average are about 2 feet long, and they can be as long as 3 feet.
Wow, yeah. How did he get out of the bar?
He just walked out on the camera, and you can kind of see this big old thing. And I'm like, they just walked out. Nobody saw him, you know, caught him. And because you can't just put it under your jacket and just leave.
No, you can't. You know? I didn't know it was that big.
So, yeah, it's pretty big.
I do wonder, like, how they came into possession of the bone originally. That sounds like an interesting story, potentially.
Yeah, yeah. Very interesting. And they have, and there was a TikTok video of this. And I wonder
what kind of conversations have been sparked over the years at Donkey's Place over the bone, because it's supposed to be a conversation starter.
And there are many of photos of people holding the bone.
Yeah.
Clearly in conversation.
And I'd love to be one of those people someday holding the bone at Donkey's Place. So you, sir.
Bring it back.
Whoever stole the bone, bring the walrus bone back to Donkey's Place in Camden. I can't say that enough time. Bring the bone back to Donkey's place.
And they have the person's photo, the alleged person's photo, like floating around on TikTok. So.
How are you going to offload that thing, by the way, a hot walrus bone?
I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, you're going to take that to a pawn shop? They're going to spot that thing a mile away.
They're going to start conversations at home. Hey.
Oh, yeah. You think they're going to keep it for themselves?
Maybe.
Well, everyone needs one for their collection. That's a good point.
I hope they didn't just toss it somewhere. You know, I just hope that they do have it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it's important for the company. Anyway.
Bring back the bone. Also, bring back your attention to our topic this hour, which is the agenda on Capitol Hill and what Congress is going to be up to, if anything, in 2026. We want to hear your thoughts. 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. Bring back the bone.
Bring it back.
Oh boy, welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Lawmakers came back to Capitol Hill this week after the stunning news of the Venezuela strike. They'd been kept in the dark in the lead up to the operation and have been getting briefings over the past few days.
Reaction in Congress has split largely along party lines, with Republicans praising the president's initiative and Democrats calling it dangerous and illegal. And while that's all taking up most of the spotlight, big issues from last year have not gone away, like healthcare subsidies and the Epstein files, most of which have still not been released.
And the midterms are quickly approaching, with some important primaries just months away. Those elections will now weigh into every political calculation for both parties moving forward. And yesterday, President Trump expressed his own fears about what's at stake.
You got to win the midterms, because if we don't win the midterms, it's just going to be, I mean, they'll find a reason to impeach me. I'll get impeached.
And so this hour, we're talking about the political battles of 2026 with two great reporters to walk us through the strategies, policy issues that will be dominating this election year. Domenico Montanaro is senior political editor and correspondent for NPR's Washington Desk. Domenico, welcome back to the program.
Good to see you again.
And Daniela Diaz is congressional reporter for Notice. Daniela, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, and to our listeners at home on the road and elsewhere, we want to hear from you this hour. Our questions of the day are this: what issue do you think should dominate the agenda on Capitol Hill this year? And how do you think the Venezuelan strike will influence the midterms, if at all? You can give us a call, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, keep those comments coming in the live chat.
Start with you, Daniela. Congress is getting up to speed on what happened in Venezuela. The question lingering out there is what they might do in response, if anything. What do you see as the possible scenarios for a congressional response, and what do you think is most likely here?
Look, when I talked to Republicans and Democrats about this, I mean, there was just a briefing that wrapped with Secretary of State Marco Rubio briefing reporters. It might still be happening. It was happening a minute ago. Look, when I talk to them, they tell me that their biggest questions going into this briefing is what's next for how the United States is going to work with Venezuela going forward. Look, we know that the vice president is now the interim president. Those questions are answered, but they have a lot of questions about what could be done. I mean, they go into these briefings, especially Democrats who have been more critical of this move than Republicans, with Republicans praising the Trump administration for doing this. Democrats saying, we don't like that there was not a lot of transparency on this ahead of the capture of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. But also, it doesn't seem that the Trump administration has a plan for how to handle this going forward to prevent more instability in this region on this issue. So whether or not that was told to lawmakers behind closed doors remains to be seen. A lot of them in these briefings coming out and saying, look, we want to talk to you about what we're hearing behind these closed doors, but there's still a lot that needs to be sorted out behind closed doors, especially in these private skiffs where these briefings are taking place on Capitol Hill. And so these questions are largely remaining, especially as Congress moves forward in the Senate on a war's power resolution that would restrict the United States' role in Venezuela going forward, which Democrats are really, really pushing for.
Yeah. Explain this resolution to us, Daniela. What would it do and what are its chances of success from our vantage point of, you know, this moment in time?
This comes after the Democratic Party, largely Democrats in both chambers, have been incredibly criticizing, critical of the administration, considering that this happened without congressional approval. Now, it's not just Democrats saying this, to be clear. It is also Republicans saying, look, we are glad that the Trump administration did this, but we would love to see more transparency going forward on how this would happen. And when I talked to Democrats, also to be clear, they did believe something needed to be done about Venezuela. Look, Senator Mark Warner, the top intel chief in the Senate, Democrat, he told me just a few days ago, while I believe that this was the right move, we needed more transparency. So what this resolution is going to do is limit what the administration can do going forward. They want more transparency. They want Congress more looped in on any sort of intel information that the administration is going to do, that the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, is going to do when it comes to Venezuela going forward. Yeah. But to be clear, while Democrats are moving forward with this, and there is one Republican in the Senate, Senator Rand Paul, who has said that he endorses this, it's unlikely to get enough votes as of now. Of course, that can change. Everything changes on Capitol Hill. But they do need at least three more Republicans to sign on to this for all Democrats to get behind this. And I believe, as of an hour ago, Senator John Fetterman from Pennsylvania just said he was not behind this resolution. So it could be an incredibly complicated move for Democrats to get enough support.
Yeah. And Domenico, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. And also, you know, just a Republican response, because it seems right now that most Republicans are supporting the president on this move.
Yeah. And I don't think that's going to change very much. I mean, I spent some time watching Fox News, for example, in the immediate moments after the incursion in Venezuela. And, you know, it was back to sort of 2003, 2004 hawkish talking points pre-Iraq war. You know, there was a lot of, you know, just talking about how there weren't that many people in Venezuela who were that supportive of Maduro or coming out and talking in favor of him. They were talking about holding up Democratic talking points to be mocked about the legality of this. So I think it's something that you're going to see a rallying around. We've already started to see that. And it's not surprising in the Trump era that you have Republicans who are, you know, really rallying around Trump. And I will say that it sort of goes back to the traditional stance that a lot of Republicans have had on intervention worldwide. You know, I think that Trump really made Republicans uncomfortable in many respects, sort of sawing off one of the legs of the three-legged stool of the Republican Party in national security hawkishness. His whole America First non-intervention campaigning, you know, made a lot of people have to swallow what they felt was what they wanted to see, which was a strong American intervention abroad. Now, they will say that this is not you know, a war, that this was a one-time event, that they were, as Secretary of State Marco Rubio said, a law enforcement retrieval operation, essentially. But, you know, it's clearly a bold move, something that I think a lot of people woke up on Saturday morning saying, the United States did what?
Yeah, that's clearly the case with a lot of U.S. allies.
Well,
let me ask you to follow up on that, Domenico. You're sensing there's a lot of rallying to the cause right now among Republicans. Mm-hmm. Some people have noted J.D. Vance, 2028 hopeful,
quiet,
not saying a whole lot. He's more attached his brand to the non-intervention America First wing of the Republican Party, if that if such a wing truly exists. Do you think there are any fissures here or any fissures that could open up if the Venezuela intervention lasts a month, 6 months, a year?
Well, I think that's a separate sort of thing. It's sort of like, how does this unspool? I think that that's an important factor, obviously, in what winds up happening here, because clearly the United States has been stuck in nation building for the, you know, for more than two centuries in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's a big reason why Trump won in the first place. It's a big reason why Barack Obama won when he was able to beat out Hillary Clinton, because he was able to say that, you know, this adventure in Iraq was the wrong move. And, you know, if this were to go on a while, and there was the United States with real, you know, imprint in Venezuela trying to run the buses and American troops were in harm's way, then I think we would see a different outcome potentially politically. That's not just because of ideologically with the MAGA base, but because Americans in general just don't want to be stuck in nation building. But that's not really what looks like is going on here. You know, when Trump says we're going to be running Venezuela, the United States is going to be running Venezuela, that he's in charge, it really has to do with oil. It doesn't really have to do with, you know, running day-to-day operations in Venezuela. It doesn't have to do with crime on the streets and policing there. It doesn't even have to do with seemingly changing over a dictatorial regime to create a more pro-democratic regime. Because really what's happened is you have a regime that's in place that's, essentially the Maduro regime just without Maduro. So that, I think, is going to be a big question on what happens in Venezuela as well and how much of that filters up to the United States.
Yeah, and Daniela, I want to bring you back into the conversation because, to me, a timing question always pops into my head because at the end of the year, we were talking about affordability, we were talking about healthcare, and on January 1st, healthcare prices went up. And then all of a sudden, we have this operation happening in Venezuela and the news cycle totally shifts. And then today, I'm watching the news, acquisition of Greenland comes up. Just your thoughts. Is anybody talking about the acquisition of Greenland? And do you see this sort of an opportunity for Republicans to sort of reset the narrative of what the American people are focused on as we start this year?
That's a great question, because if you ask Democrats what the reason that this, capture in Venezuela took place, when you ask Democrats about anything President Donald Trump is doing, they say it's to distract from the affordability crisis or the rising healthcare costs, to take the narrative away from those issues. It's really interesting that you bring up Greenland, because it actually, from what I was told by my sources, came up in the briefings today and potentially earlier this week on Capitol Hill when it came to briefings on what happened with Nicolas Maduro. But Republicans and Democrats in these briefings weren't sharing much about how the Greenland issue came up. Republicans have widely, and just to include what Domenico said very well, just praise Donald Trump. And that's always been the case on Capitol Hill. When you talk to rank and file Republicans, though, they say it's time to try to bring the attention back on domestic issues. That's always been the criticism that voters had of President Donald Trump, especially in those special elections in November, where we saw Democrats with wide wins, because they say that President Donald Trump promised to help Americans in the country on domestic issues, and that's just not been the case. Polls have shown that he's losing his support for this. And now we've seen what's took place in Venezuela to continue attracting attention on foreign issues, and this America First policy not really being what President Donald Trump is following through on when he's so focused on what's happening overseas. Mm. So it's going to continue being an issue on Capitol Hill, especially leading into the midterms. And it's something Democrats really believe could be something that helps them going into the midterms.
Yeah. Janice says, for better or worse, Venezuela will definitely still be a thing, as will healthcare. And who knows what else will be top of mind come November.
Brian from Morristown, one of our regulars, agrees with the premise that the Venezuela incursion is, quote, a PR stunt, to use his words. It's a distraction with which the media happily goes along with because it's news. I think there is a question, though, in my mind of whether as a political distraction purely, Domenico, it is doing what it's supposed to do, if indeed that's the way the administration views it. If they view this as a way to shift the focus off of domestic issues, do voters actually take their eye off domestic issues when the attention goes to places like Venezuela or potentially Greenland? I mean, what does your gut tell you? What does the polling tell us, Domenico?
Well, in the short term, it certainly changed the subject. There can be wide conspiracies on the wag the dog theories and all of that kind of thing. And it's not that far of a leap to suggest that what Trump has done in some respects is partially to change the subject. Every TV yesterday was certainly on Maduro in New York, awaiting his trial. I think long term, voters in this country care about prices.
Yeah.
And that's what they've continued to say over and over again. It's why Trump won in the first place. It's why so many voters crossed over to vote for him, who aren't part of the MAGA base. in 2024. And I think given that Democrats did as well as they did electorally in 2025, it had to do with the cost of living. And if they're going to do well again in 2026, it's going to have to do with the cost of living. And, you know, I think Trump sort of acknowledged yesterday in his speech to House Republicans, the history and how difficult it is for presidents for their parties to do well in midterm elections. And he was kind of hands off a little bit, yeah. A little bit resigned to the fact that maybe Republicans won't win, but that they should focus on some of these other things like transgender athletes in sports, immigration, crime, voter ID laws, and connecting sort of all of those together. In fact, he said transgender athletes in sports was such a strong issue he felt that he wouldn't even talk about it until a week before the election because it could really change the direction of a race. But at the end of the day, all of those culture issues are certainly the glue that has bound MAGA together, but it's not necessarily what's going to help his party win in 2026, most likely, especially in an out year, in a year that when the president's party is in power, because usually it's the party out of power that gets to register their frustration in these off year and midterm elections. And we certainly saw that in 2025.
Yeah, by the way, I want to remind our listeners on the road and elsewhere that our questions of the day are: what issue do you think should dominate the agenda on Capitol Hill this year? And how do you think the Venezuelan strike will influence the midterms? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, keep those comments coming in the chat. Jaquan Jordan 5401 on YouTube says, inflation needs to be slowed down. We understand it can't be stopped, but geez, I'm only 33. Cost has quadrupled in my short lifetime, says Jaquan Jordan. And so, Daniela, my question to you is, you know, the big story that we were anticipating was going to be the story was healthcare, right? And that was supposed to, there was a vote that didn't necessarily happen correctly right before the end of the year. Is there something brewing now? Because people's healthcare prices have gone up. And it's getting real. This is the first month and we haven't felt the real temperature of it yet, but it's going to start heating up.
Exactly. I don't want to get too much into congressional procedure because it can get really boring.
Really quick.
Don't want to subject anyone too much to that, but I do want to say that there is going to be a procedural vote in just a few hours to move a petition that was led by Democrats, the minority party in the House. Of course, they have the minority. They're the minority party in the House and the Senate. But this is specifically happening in the House that four Republicans joined in on. Three of those Republicans being from Pennsylvania, yeah. Wow. Brian Fitzpatrick, Robert Bresnahan, and Ryan McKenzie, the three, yep. Pennsylvania. Yeah, they're centrists. They come from tough districts, and they're working with Democrats to try to pass something on the Affordable Care Act subsidies because they recognize, as do many rank and file Republicans, by the way. I've spoken to so many of them over the past couple of months on this issue here on Capitol Hill. That's where I'm talking to you from. But they recognize that they need to do something on this. So they actually joined Democrats on a procedural tool where they could force a vote on the House floor to extend Affordable Care Act subsidies, these tax credits that'll keep premiums down. So this is major. I mean, as a Capitol Hill nerd, I can't emphasize enough how unlikely this is to happen for the rank and file Republicans, the majority party, to join Democrats to try to do this. It's expected to pass when they have the final vote tomorrow. Now, everything remains unclear in the Senate because they actually had a vote on this specific legislation in December that failed. There was not enough Republican senators to vote on this. But the thing is that everyone widely recognizes, Republicans, Democrats, even President Donald Trump, that this is something that they need to deal with. We've seen President Donald Trump have a very hands-off approach on this issue, leading it to leadership on the Hill to really deal with. But Speaker Mike Johnson has been eager to wait to see how President Donald Trump has led on this, considering, you know, they often defer to the president on this issue. Domenico can speak more on that side of the White House of Pennsylvania Ave, but on the Hill, it's not going to go away. I mean, that's what caused the entire shutdown, right? Mm-hmm. And Democrats don't plan to let this go, considering it was such a winning issue for them. This is why they were able to win those elections in the latter half of 2025, was because they want to keep costs low for Americans. And it seems to be that everyone cares about this right now.
Yeah. And that was my follow-up question to you, Domenico, because, you know, Republicans have had this "I hate Obamacare" attitude for years. And so now they have to swallow it in some regard and have a fix to prop this program up if they have any chance of not like further angering many Americans. Your thoughts on how they're going to approach this, because this is teeing up to be another big issue, and it's coming fast because some of the first primaries for the midterms are just weeks away.
The opposition to the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare from Republicans, I said yesterday, has been more than a decade. You know, it's almost two decades at this point. 2009 is when the Affordable Care Act passed. Republicans have certainly had, years to figure it out. As Trump said yesterday, he told Republicans and in the House conference, you got to figure it out. You know, figure out how you're going to give people the money and not the insurance companies. And he said he read about that in the Wall Street Journal last year and just said, wow, that's a great issue. What a great way to talk about it. Republicans should own healthcare. It's one thing to say that kind of thing and have that kind of catchy slogan when you're campaigning for president. It's another thing to have to go and legislate on it, as Daniela knows how difficult that is, to go and get any of these kinds of things actually affected, and then for people to feel it and to feel good about it. You know, Obamacare, when it first came on board, obviously with all the opposition to it, there was a lot, obviously, of opposition. It's a reason why in 2010, Democrats lost 63 seats in the House. It's why Barack Obama said that the Democrats took a shellacking, his word. And now, when you look at KFF's tracking poll on the Affordable Care Act and where it rates with people, it has, you know, near 60% favorability rating, near the highest it's ever been. So if you're going to campaign against the Affordable Care Act again, not have a replacement, and people's subsidies are going to, or premiums are going to go up, and almost double for many people. You know, if you're a swing voter, if you're a swing member of Congress, if you're a Republican, frontline Republican, like Danielle's talking about, why do you go along with trying to, you know, do a discharge petition here and try to vote with Democrats? Well, because you're out for your job. You're trying to keep your job here. And it's a really kind of almost desperate attempt to say, I get it. I see how hard it is. And we need to do something, at least temporarily, before there's something else that can get passed. But it's not a majority, or even close to a majority, of Republicans, and certainly not the prevailing feeling at the White House.
Penny Scott Sedley on YouTube wants everyone in the U.S. House to retire or be voted out. Real quickly, before we get to the break, Domenico, there are a lot of retirements, and we could have more. Just how volatile could this midterm election be on the House side when you consider all of the potential incumbents who might not be running, or definitely not running?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things that are indicative of potential wave for the other party. One is whether or not the other party does well in special elections and off-year elections. Well, check and check for Democrats on that. The other one is what you're talking about, is retirements and whether or not one party is seeing significantly more retirements. It isn't significantly more right now, but there are a lot of Republicans and Democrats who are retiring or not running for re-election. There are more Republicans who are not running for re-election to their seat. So I do think that that's another potential thing. Now, the place where Republicans are insulated is because of gerrymandering. A lot of these seats have tilted more to the right. We've seen fewer and fewer competitive seats over the last couple of decades. So the idea that there could be a huge wave, even of 2018 standards, where Trump's party lost 40 seats, that's probably unlikely. But hey, with a 3-seat majority and now less, with a very razor-thin majority here that Republicans have, even half a dozen to a dozen seats would could make the difference. Switch control.
And on the other side of this break, I want to talk about some of the big races,
yes,
primaries and generals that are coming up. The ones that you guys have your eyes on, talking to Daniela Diaz, who covers politics in Congress for Notice, and Domenico Montanaro, NPR senior politics editor and correspondent. We'd love to hear from you.
We got comments.
888-477-9499, studio2 at whyy.org. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here at WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. This hour, we've been looking at what's ahead in politics in 2026, with the midterms now coloring all of the policy fights and party strategy. Obviously, Venezuela has captured the focus in Congress this week, but there are lots of other issues out there, like healthcare subsidies and the Epstein files. Only a small percent have been released so far, by the way. And the potential for another shutdown at the end of January if lawmakers can't figure out funding.
And let me reintroduce our guests. We have Domenico Montanaro, senior political editor and correspondent for NPR's Washington desk. We also have Daniela Diaz. She covers politics in Congress for Notice. And of course, our question of the day for you, our listeners at home, on the road, and or elsewhere, are this: what issue do you think should dominate the agenda on Capitol Hill this year? And how do you think the Venezuelan strike will influence the midterms? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2 at whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, keep those comments coming in the chat. I want to bring in a caller. We have Bernie from Kensington on the line. Bernie, you're on Studio 2. What's your take?
Hey, great show, great topic. I think that costs, and in particular healthcare costs, are going to be still a major topic in the upcoming elections. But I think the Republicans actually, I'm on Obamacare, mm-hmm. and my premiums have nearly doubled, and I'm not happy about that. But I think the Republicans have one good point, and that is, maybe they have more than one good point, but this one is that if people had enough money to pay for their own health care, they would be much more judicious in choosing their providers and shop around for a lower cost, because there's no, right now with insurance, it just pays for it. You know, you don't really shop around. And as a result, I think that's one of the reasons that healthcare costs are so high, because there's really no competition and shopping around by people. And I'm not a Republican, but I think they have a good point in that.
Thank you, Bernie from Kensington.
So look, that's obviously going to be one of the Republican talking mm-hmm. points when it comes to fixing, reforming healthcare, abolishing Obamacare, if that ever truly happens. And I'm guessing it'll come up in some primary fights. I'm curious if there are any primary fights out there, maybe U.S. Senate races that you're really interested in, that you think could be bellwethers for where either party is heading. I'll start with you, Daniela. Any races? We've got Texas, we've got Michigan, Minnesota, California. Any big ones that you're really keeping an eye on?
I hope I'm not stealing anything from Domenico when he gets this question, but there's two that I think are really, really interesting, and I'm a little biased because I'm from one of these states. You know, I've lived in D.C. for over a decade, but I'm from Texas.
All right. The Lone Star State.
Yeah, that's a big one.
I think that both of those primaries, the Republican primary and the Democratic primary, are incredibly interesting, because you're really seeing what mess can really happen when it comes to politics. I mean, it writes itself, these stories. You've got on the Republican side, you've got Ken Paxton, who has had a longstanding feud with John Cornyn. John Cornyn, who has feuded with Donald Trump in the past. And then Wesley Hunt, a Black Republican who is really mixing up this race. And then on the Democratic side, we saw Colin Allred drop out because he didn't really have a chance. But you have James Tallarico, a newcomer, I've been calling him kind of a Buttigieg-esque newbie, because he comes from local politics. He's trying his hand on a national stage, has been doing really well online. To Jasmine Crockett, you know, a big personality on Capitol Hill, goes viral a lot, also wanting to win that primary. It really does write itself. It's really interesting, especially considering Notice, my publication, was actually the one to report that it was Republicans really urging Jasmine Crockett to get into this race because they think that they could beat her in a general election. Mm. So really interesting. Also, just really quick, I think the main Democratic primary is really interesting. Mm-hmm. It's really both sides of the Democratic Party on display. Janet Mills, who, if she were elected, would be the oldest freshman in the Senate. you know, after what we saw with Joe Biden, really would be interesting if that happened. And then Graham Plattner, a Bernie Sanders-esque Democrat who has some controversies that he's still trying to get over. I'll leave it there. But yeah. I do find this to be, you know, really interesting political stories and a really good test of what to come in both sides of the party going forward.
Yeah, Domenico, you want to add one or weigh in on any of those races? The big primaries coming up, and it doesn't have to just be U.S. Senate, that you think are going to tell us where either party is heading.
Well, I think the ball game is the House.
Yeah.
You know, I think that the Senate is a much higher hill for Democrats to climb. And that's just based on the numbers. I mean, you know, the Cook Political Report looks at it and, you know, there's like five Republican seats that are from toss up to likely are only two Republican seats that are qualified as toss up right now. Two Democratic seats in Georgia and Michigan as well. So there just aren't, you know, the landscape isn't really there for Democrats to be able to make that kind of push without a huge wave, which, you know, could happen. I think Democrats' sights are more set on the House. And I think it's interesting because when you look at Cook's ratings, I was just crunching before we came on, how things have changed in the past year. In February of 2025, there were 18 toss-ups. 10 of those were Democratic-held seats. 8 were Republican seats. Didn't seem like, you know, that's kind of a wash. Now that's dropped to 5 Democratic seats and up to 12 Republican seats. So I think that shows you, you know, just kind of how the tide has sort of shifted a bit over the past year. Even so, those numbers aren't like huge numbers. And I think redistricting is the place that we're going to have to see. That arms race is going to tell us a lot about just how much Republicans are able to insulate themselves even more, or are Democrats able to you know, go and offset some of those gains. I think that someone like Gavin Newsom, for example, probably helped his 2028 stock by being able to get that that ballot measure through to say that the state could be allowed to redistrict. It had an independent commission, and now they're going to be able to redraw their state to try to offset Texas's potential 5 seats that lean toward Republicans, that California will try to maybe get 5 that lean toward Democrats. But I have to say, especially Danielle being from Texas, I think it's interesting that Republicans think that they can win these couple seats in South Texas and rely on the fact that Latinos had shifted as they did in 2024. Yeah. I think it's a huge gamble on their part, one that could really boomerang and backfire on them, because I don't think that Latinos are in any party's camp necessarily writ large. You know, clearly they lean slightly more Democratic, but in 2024, Trump won a higher percentage of Latinos than any Republican in history. But we've seen anything but Trump maintaining those numbers in 2025, where we've really just seen Latino support for Trump just fall off.
Yeah, Daniela, you wanted to chime in on that, it sounds like.
I'm from there, so I have a lot of thoughts about South Texas. I'm from the Rio Grande Valley, was just there over the holidays. I mean, Domenico's completely correct. I wrote a story about whether Latinos were the new swing voters, which is, you know, you heard President Donald Trump talk about Latino voters after the election. He was so confident that they were new to the party and staying. That is not the case.
Yeah.
They, you know, going back to our conversation earlier, they just want to be able to pay their rent. I mean, I talk to Latino voters all the time. They want to be able to put gas in their car. They want to be able to afford their health care. Those are going to be the winning issues going into the 2026 midterms. And that is why we're seeing, you know, rank and file Republicans raise their hands, because they understand that this is what they have to really focus on here on Capitol Hill.
I want to ask you a quick question, because Eustace online said Venezuela will matter to Hispanic voters. Absolutely. That will keep Republicans in control. And I wanted to throw that to you, Daniela. Do you think that the Venezuelan issue matters to Latino voters enough to keep them in the Republican Party at all?
I think so. Look, it's not, Latino voters are not a monolith. There are many Latino voters who have roots in Venezuela. Every Latino voter that I spoke to following what happened with Nicolas Maduro celebrated that President Donald Trump and the administration took action there. But I think what folks really need to consider, especially the fact that Latino voters are not a monolith, is that it's complicated. There are states that have more Venezuelan population, more Cuban population, more Colombians, more Mexicans. It just depends on the groups and where their focus is when it comes to foreign affairs and how they believe that the administration needs to act. Look, we've seen a lot of force against immigrants in the United States when it comes to ICE and immigration and what DHS has been doing. That has swayed a lot of voters, thinking that, you know, when I talk to voters, Latino voters, they haven't liked the force that the administration had used. I mean, it's not a, a black and white issue when it comes to how Latino voters are responding to this. But it, it is an important thing to focus that there is a population that celebrates what happened on Saturday or in the early mornings of Saturday Venezuela.
Thank you
if
for
we
that.
If we were talking about swing districts in South Florida, this would certainly make more sense than swing districts in South Texas. There's a very different sort of population. Not to mention, Texas Latinos skew more Republican than Latinos in almost any other part of the country. So we can't, like Danielle said, we can't talk about Latinos like they all vote in one way. And oh, this Venezuela, you know, removal happened, and then they're suddenly all about insulating Trump. Maybe the White House views it that way in some respects, but that would be, again, more of a South Florida thing than it would be Texas thing.
And I wanted to shift a bit because we only have about 5 minutes left in the show, but I wanted to ask you about strategy because, you know, President Donald Trump has been, you know, sort of, he in the past, he stumped for Republicans pretty loudly. And I'm wondering what the thought process will be, you know, going into the midterms, given the fact that he has low poll numbers in the 30s, not as quite as his all-time low, but it's like 36% approve of some of the stuff that he's doing. Just your thoughts on, Domenico, just on how the Republicans use President Trump as they try to hold on to control.
Trump has always had a great record on endorsements and campaigning when it comes to red states and red districts. Not so much when it comes to swing districts. So Susie Wiles, chief of staff, says that she hasn't even told Trump yet, but he's going to be out there more. Let's see just how much and where.
We still haven't talked about the Epstein files, when they will be released, how much, and like how damaging this is politically for the president. I go back and forth on this, Danielle. I do think this issue does break through to a lot of Americans, but it's also pretty far divorced from the affordability healthcare issues we've been talking about that tend to be bread and butter for those swing voters. What do you see happening on Epstein, Daniela, over the next few months? And do you think it is politically consequential?
Well, I've covered this since since Democrats and Republicans, you know, Republicans meaning Thomas Massie and the handful that joined him, put that discharge petition on the floor to force that vote, to compel the DOJ to release these files. Lo and behold, before the holidays, they only released about 5 to 10% of the files that apparently the DOJ has hit their hands on. And MAGA is upset. They want to see all the files. They want to see all of the names. And while the DOJ has said, you know, we saw Todd Blanche, you know, go through all the Sunday shows just a few weeks ago saying, look, we're doing our best to scrub these, you know, to not disclose personal information of victims. That's a huge priority for everyone involved in this issue. But they really want to see the files. I mean, a lot of folks say that the Democrats have weaponized this issue on Capitol Hill, critics, because they say this is obviously an issue that they can win on. But it was MAGA that started this in the very beginning, the MAGA base. And President Donald Trump campaigned on this. The fact that these files have not been released is huge. And it does point to questions about why they haven't released all of these files yet. And the excuses are not enough for the MAGA base, who have complained that they want to see them. So this is going to continue to be an issue. You know, of course, affordability is the number one issue on Capitol Hill, but I personally do not see this going away anytime soon. And this drip, drip, drip could actually add to the fact that this does not end anytime soon. Maybe if they released it once, it would end any of the questions, but the fact that they haven't, you know, could raise more questions.
Before we wrap up, David Bagan on YouTube, one of our regulars, wants to know about the possibility of another government shutdown. January 30th is the next deadline. Domenico, my sense of it just from afar is that Democrats are not spoiling for another big fight on this. Maybe I'm wrong. You're reading the tea leaves, I'm sure, as well. What's your sense of the possibility of another shutdown here?
Yeah, and I would defer to Daniela more specifically on this, but my sense also is that they made their point on healthcare subsidies. They want to get the vote that they're going to get on this here, but whether or not they're going to push again to shut down the government, I think is a pretty is a move that I don't think a lot of them are spoiling. Is a fight that not a lot of them are spoiling to have again this quickly, especially when they feel like they have the wind at their backs on affordability and prices and being able to place the blame on President Trump.
Yeah, 30 seconds left. Daniela, do you generally agree with that?
Absolutely. Domenico put it very succinctly and perfectly. But I would just add that, again, not trying to get into too much congressional procedure, but they are passing appropriations bills. They're working on that. That's always been the issue, is trying to define government spending, top line numbers. And it does seem like Democrats and Republicans are working in good faith right now in the next couple of weeks to try to pass these appropriations bills to fund the government. So if that were the case, there probably won't be a shutdown.
Yeah. Well,
All
there you
right,
have it. Daniela
David.
Diaz covers politics and Congress for Notice. Daniela, thanks so much for being on Studio 2. And Domenico Montanaro, NPR senior politics editor and correspondent. Great to see you again, Domenico.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and thanks to everybody who called in, all our folks on YouTube and Facebook, and everybody who commented online and emailed in. And thanks, of course, to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calicay engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
Yeah, big ups to our producers today.
Yeah,
big ups. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
Did the switcheroo. Thank you.
We'll talk to you tomorrow.